Headlines.
Live from Washington, D.C., the capital of the divided states of America, it's time for the show that brings you both sides of the issues that matter. In the left corner, I'm political analyst and progressive Democrat Garland Nixon.
And bumping into things on the right corner, I am Republican investigative reporter Lee Stranahan.
Welcome to the most disruptive show in America, Fault Lines, with Nixon and Stranahan. In round one, explosive new information today as CNN is reporting that former FBI Director Comey drafted a Clinton exoneration memo long before the investigation into her email server was complete. In round two, the latest jobs numbers for August show weaker numbers. Is the concept of a Trump economy a false one? Then, in round three, Lee and I go over our weekly roundup as we discuss a variety of topics, including today's Imran Awan hearing and former Blackwater owner Eric Prince's Huffington Post interview about Afghanistan. That and more coming up on today's episode of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Hey there, Garland. So, you know, I realize we've been teasing people all week that we have a couple of major announcements
coming.
Well,
we did tell them that we'd be taking calls. So starting next week, we're going to take some calls, which is going to be fun.
I figured out something we can say.
All right.
Ready? Because we talked about this today. So here's what we want to tell. First off, we appreciate everybody listening. We're over 100 shows now here at Fault Lines. We are the most disruptive radio show in America, and we're about to get a lot more interesting. Here's why. Ready?
Okay.
Garland doesn't know what I'm going to say, and he's a little nervous. I can tell. He's a little worried. Here's what we can say for sure. Garland and I talked about this today. And one thing I can tell you without revealing any secrets is that you are going to see the show become, Garland and I both want this to be the definitive news source for you.
That's
where,
right.
Where we give you a variety of, we're going to have callers, we're going to have guests, we're going to have also a variety of topics, and there's going to be a little less bickering. It's not going to completely go.
Well, we still have to have the pre-show.
We
still have to have our pre-show discussion. So there'll be plenty of bickering there.
No.
You just won't hear all of it, but there'll be some.
But the thing we talked about was that there's a real need, I think, for a news source that actually brings you both sides of the issues.
Yep.
And that actually brings you stories that the mainstream media is covering, but also that they're not covering.
Yep.
And that's the thing we'll be able to do. So I just want to say thanks very much, everybody. Before we get into the Labor Day weekend, we're not going to be here on Monday. But before we get into that, I wanted to thank all of our listeners. We're building up quite an audience. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors.
And if you get a chance, if you're anywhere near the TV tomorrow at approximately 1:30, which usually means sometime between 1:20 and 1:40, but approximately 1:30. I'll be on the Fox News channel tomorrow on America's News headquarters talking about something. They haven't told me what, Lee, so I have no idea what I'll be talking about on Fox News tomorrow. But all I know is there'll be a lot of pretty girls around and it'll be a blast because it's Fox News.
That's exactly right.
It's what they do.
That's the one part of their... Let's see if Breitbart does a TV play. If my friend Steve Bannon is out there working, let's see if he does the pretty girl thing.
He's good to get, if he's going to compete with Fox News, he's got to go there. Usually,
because I love Steve, but if he's the look of the TV network,
no, it ain't going nowhere.
Because you've seen Steve.
Yeah, I mean, he can't like hire guys that look like you and I, kind of standing around here.
By the way, I'm not knocking Steve. If Steve and I were out, the ladies would be looking at him. Probably because he's like a millionaire. Okay, let's go with that. And I'm married. But okay, fine.
But he's going to have to go with like Elizabeth Prawn. That's who I go on a lot of times with on the weekend, Elizabeth Prawn.
One other thing I'll mention before we get rolling, because we got a lot to talk about today, is that if you want to watch the radio show, you can watch it either on, are we on Facebook today, guys? We are not. So don't forget I said anything about that. But you can go to my Twitter feed, @Stranahan, and watch us on Periscope Live right now, or... You can also, while you're there, make sure you follow Garland Nixon @GarlandNixon over on Twitter. So let's talk about this.
This is interesting.
This Comey thing.
Apparently Chuck Grassley and Lindsey Graham have said this in a statement, and they're citing transcripts of interviews with former aides to FBI Director James Comey. So these are FBI guys, I guess you'll say it. So apparently, here's what happened. Months before, you know, in July, the FBI director came out and made a statement and said that he wasn't going to charge former Secretary Clinton with any violations of the law, right, based on her email server. And apparently, either April or May, he had drafted a statement, that statement about exonerating her, months before the end of the investigation, passed it around to people to look at. And I'm getting various numbers, but of how many people hadn't been investigated. But here's what we know. There were at least two people who had been granted immunity who hadn't been interviewed. And Secretary Clinton herself hadn't been interviewed. What's interesting, the interesting thing about
Let me ask you this, Carl.
Go ahead.
You're an investigator. You've done investigations.
Let me just say this. So for those who don't know, I was a police officer. I retired as a major. And at one point, I was the chief of the investigations division. Or major police department.
I don't want to use a technical term, but does this sound fishy?
There's something rotten in Denver, which I'll be in Denver in 2 weeks. And I think the story may have originated in Denver because something's rotten there.
It's Denmark.
Denver. I'll be in
Denver.
It's
not Denver. It's Denmark. But no, as an investigator, does this sound weird to you?
Yeah, let me just say, if I some got people under me had, because I didn't actually do them myself, if some people under me had an investigation going on and the guy in charge or girl in charge started writing letters of exoneration before they'd finished interrogating the suspect,
are you questioning whether Comey's a guy or a girl? Because you said or a girl.
I'm saying under me, that work for me.
Oh, I see. I thought you had breaking news here.
No.
But keep going. Okay.
And I found out that they were writing letters of exoneration letters before they had finished interrogating and interviewing, and particularly the suspect. It would pique my interest. Here's something that's interesting about it. You know, a lot of times when somebody gives you the story, when they give you their reasoning, it makes you wonder. So someone, apparently a source, we always know, some person who pushed back on this. It says, a person familiar with the matter pushed back on the notion that Comey had already reached a conclusion that affected the investigation, right? This is the CNN story. But here's the problem with that, Lee. So they have all of these reasons that, okay, they've said, the person said the agents and the Justice Department officials were talking about how the investigation went. And there was a belief that the evidence was going in a direction that would not support bringing charges, right? They said they'd reviewed most of the evidence. They didn't find evidence suggesting that Clinton had violated federal law. So this person's saying, look, that's not weird, because by that point, it was April, and we kind of felt that she wasn't going to be charged. So Director Comey wrote the letter that was started writing a letter that said she wasn't going to be charged. So apparently they're saying that. Here's the problem. The next sentence. The source also said Comey was not involved in the day-to-day steps of the investigation. So even if he reached a conclusion, it wouldn't have affected the results of the investigation. So if he wasn't involved in the investigation, in the day-to-day investigation, how did he know what direction it was pointing? How could he say, in the first paragraph, you say that the evidence was showing that she wasn't probably going to be charged. And then the second paragraph says, but he didn't know what was going on anyway.
And by the way,
none of it makes sense to me.
And this letter came, and you should read that. People should read the original letter. We'll post it on populist.tv. That's a hint to Eric, my front page editor. That's a little hint to Eric. But we should post this. People should read the whole letter. In the letter, Lindsey Graham and Chuck Grassley say, this is a quote, it is unclear whether the FBI agents actually investigating the case were aware that Mr. Comey had already decided on the investigator's outcome while their work was ongoing. Now, that's a pretty major breach. Now, the other thing Garland and I were talking about with this, I mean, that is just a major breach of trust for the investigators. What this means is, if that's accurate, that this whole thing was a dog and pony show.
Let's not forget.
Am I right, though?
Yeah. Let's not forget.
It's a fishy dog and pony
show. You'll probably remember who it was. One of the people, I think it was the guy who was the acting investigator after him, testified that there were people in the investigation, there were people in the FBI that were unhappy with the outcome. Remember that? There was the guy, what's the guy's name that was the acting investigator when they first fired Comey? I forgot his name. But they brought him on to testify, and he testified that there were people in the FBI who were unhappy. They asked him, they said, is everything happy and rosy? And he said, well, everything's not perfect. There was some issues. There were some people that were unhappy with the outcome, with the way he handled the investigation and outcome of the investigation. And now we find this out, and you have to think that could have been part of it.
Well, and one of the other reasons to be aware of the mainstream media bias on this, the establishment media bias, is that I believe it's very clear if this had been a Republican, and again, remember what Hillary Clinton did here. This is not what she's accused of doing. This is what we know she did. She was supposed to use a government email account when she was Secretary of State. She was given a government email account. And the reason you're supposed to use that is in case there's a FOIA request, let's say, they want to be able to look into it. She first off never used her government email account. Now, some people like to say, well, Colin Powell also used like a Yahoo account sometimes or an AOL account. That's true, but Colin Powell also used his State Department account.
Well, and here's
she
the other
literally
part.
Never it, used
there's
it
a big
ever.
Difference. Because if you have a Yahoo account or a Hotmail account, even if you close your account or get rid of it, you can still go to Yahoo servers
right.
or Microsoft servers and get it. If you have your own server, you have full control of it and you can delete things as they did using BleachBit, but you can absolutely get rid of things. You can throw the hard drive away. So the only real way to control it so that nobody can ever get your information is to have your own server.
And that's especially true if you've got a couple of people like Hillary Clinton and her top aide, Huma Abedin, who both had private accounts on that email server in her basement. So does that make sense? In other words, they had a completely private channel. Now, why is that suspicious? First off, you're not supposed to do that. Second off, it's clear that while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and while Huma Abedin was one of her top assistants at the Secretary of State's office, Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton were also working on business related to the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, that's pretty clear.
And that the Clinton Foundation was getting large sums of money from foreign governments. We know that. And by the way, that's legal. But the question is, was there a conflict of interest? And the way you'd figure that out is with FOIA requests, is with Freedom of Information Act requests, where you'd want to see the emails back and forth.
Or now, through an investigation where the investigator could look at the emails, except the investigator couldn't look at thousands and thousands of emails because they deleted them and they used a program called BleachBit
yes.
to get rid of... to permanently get rid of the email. And let me add this, as a person, and I make no bones about it, I supported Bernie and going up to the convention. And this is why I always, I believe it's important for me to reiterate this story and to be on top of this story. Because I'm a Democrat, I've been a Democrat, and I was one of the people going into, and I am on record saying this on air, and that was, we, the Democratic Party, should never have nominated a person who was under investigation by the FBI. And then when you nominate someone who's under investigation by the FBI, and then just before the actual election happens, 2 weeks before that, so then something comes out about the FBI investigation, you don't blame the FBI. You look at the party and you say the party should have never nominated a person who was under investigation by the FBI. That was a self-inflicted wound, but you still want to blame everybody else. And I think more and more things like this, as they come out, show that the party, you know, conspired to put her out there, and it was a boneheaded move, and the party needs to stop blaming everybody else but themselves.
Here's another thing about this, and this is something I've reported on. I worked with my friend James O'Keefe on this, but there's no debate about what I'm about to say. There were people in the State Department who were, I will call them low-level bureaucrats. Does that make sense? These are people, I don't know what their politics are. I don't care what their politics are. They went to their boss, and they said, the Secretary of State is not using an email account at all she's supposed to use. There's been no use on it whatsoever. This is going to put us at risk if we're asked for FOIA requests. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And those employees were chastised by their boss. Don't bring that up again. Don't say anything out about that again. You with me? That happened. It's in the reports. It's out there. That to me is clearly it's bad.
And am I mistaken, or did they not fill, was it the Inspector General's position when Secretary Clinton was there the whole time? I'm pretty sure it was the person who's in charge of policing all of these things. They didn't fill the position.
Yeah, that may be. I'm not sure about that. I'm not. It may be. There's so much stuff that's fishy about this. And back to what I was saying about the establishment media, I have to think that if it were a Republican Secretary of State, they would be on this story every single day. So it was not clear to me, for instance, because I heard the media conflate these things with, oh, well, Colin Powell didn't do it. Hillary Clinton literally never used the email account she was given. Never. It's not like she used it for some stuff but didn't use it. That's even different. She never used it.
And, you know, I'm not going to speculate about what would happen if there was a Republican, but I can say this, that the Bernie people all said she's not going to win. The Bernie supporters, my friends, my people in my circle all said she's not going to win. People don't trust her. You know, that she can't win because people don't trust her. You know what we said?
Okay, but
we said we don't trust her and we're members of her own party.
But
you're not
the
going
partisan,
to get independence
forget
to trust
the partisan
her.
Thing for a second, because I'm really trying to be objective about this.
To me,
this.
That's not partisan. To me, that's, well, it is in that.
It is because you're looking at the practical implications. Yeah. She did something wrong, period. She did something wrong. She's admitted that it was wrong, kind of, right? But the fact is, and taking it back to what we now know, and Comey's investigation was suspect, and let's add in one other thing before we run out of time here. The Mueller investigation right now is looking into, one of the major things they're looking in, this came out today as well, is whether Donald Trump acted inappropriately by getting rid of Comey. And I'll say this. I think it's pretty clear it was appropriate to get rid of Comey. I think it was, and it's not clear in retrospect. It's not clear knowing what we know now. Comey was criticized by everyone, Democrats and Republicans. And it's only after Donald Trump booted him that the Democrats started crying about, like, oh, well, we need to investigate this. It's obstruction of justice. No, Comey needs to be investigated more. He needs to be investigated for why, when the DNC server thing happened and the DNC was not cooperating, would not give the servers multiple times at various levels, why did Comey not do something? Could it be because he knew Sean Henry from CrowdStrike, the only people to examine that? Is that a factor?
I've always wondered about this, and I don't know enough about the feds to say for sure, but based on my law enforcement experience, why didn't he attempt to get a warrant? If he felt
that
the DNC servers had been infiltrated by foreign agents and they wouldn't give it up, why didn't he go to court and say, this investigation is vital to national security, and go to a judge and say, I want a warrant. They won't give me those servers. I want a warrant to go take them. I can't say for sure that he could or couldn't do that, but it would seem to me, based on my experience, that he ought to be able to do that. I've always wondered, number one, if he didn't go get a warrant, why didn't he try, or why didn't he, did he ever go to court? I can't understand how an investigator could look at servers and say, I believe these servers have been infiltrated by a foreign agent. We'll ask for them. They won't give them up. Would you do that with any other piece of evidence in a major criminal investigation? I can't imagine that you would ask a person for the evidence.
And what we know is the media in this country is not asking these questions. They're not saying, it's very basic. They're not asking the questions. They're not doing their job. But hey, guess what? We'll be doing the job here every day on Fault Lines. That's what we do.
Because we're Fault Lines. We'll be right back in round two. Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines.
We are back. It's the first of the month, and so guess what? It's jobs numbers time. Jobs numbers were not as good as expected. We'll talk about that in a second. But interestingly, because Garland and I discussed this the other day. So here's how elitism works. Here's the way elitism works. And I said this, I think it was yesterday or the day before on the show. I said, have you noticed when the jobs numbers go down where there's massive layoffs, what does the stock market do?
It goes up.
It goes up. So right now, I think the markets are closed. I'm not keeping track. Last I checked, it was up 40 points. Now, again, whatever. And by the way, the stock market's above 21,000. It's doing very well.
They're celebrating the plight of the commoners.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like. They're like, hooray, man, the people out here are suffering. Woohoo.
Well, and, you know, here's the thing. So the jobs numbers, let's be clear about this because I don't want to misrepresent them. So 150,000 jobs were added. And the unemployment rate's up very slightly. None of this is affected by the hurricane, which is going to affect things. The next jobs report, that's clearly going to be affected.
Yeah. kind of like usually in February, you get some huge snowstorms in the Northeast that, you know, they have to revise number. Every March, they have to revise the February numbers because of a big snowstorm.
That's right. Also, interestingly, my mouth. So also, gas prices are up a lot. Gas prices are up like 16 cents in a week. Now, again, I've got to think that that's.
But what the biggest the largest refinery in America is kind of like underwater. I think that has something to do with it.
It's got
to
be, because that's a huge jump. Now, so once again, it's interesting. You know, if you watch a film like, did you see the DiCaprio film Wolf of Wall Street? Did you see that one?
No.
Scorsese. You know, I've had this feeling for a long time.
That wasn't the one where Jack Nicholson was like turned into a werewolf?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, totally. I'm not sure what that film is.
Yeah, he was like a Wall Street guy and he actually got bitten by a werewolf or something and started freaking out.
That's not really a Scorsese sounding film.
Yeah, that's my kind of movie because, you know, I like werewolf movies.
But it doesn't sound. But Wolf of Wall Street, I mean, you know, it's sort of the high flying lifestyle of the people doing trading. And I've never, it's always, again, you know, maybe it's just me, but I've always thought the stock market seemed like kind of a sucker's game. Like, I don't completely understand it. It seems like I do kind of understand it, but I go like, wow, it just seems like a sucker's game. It seems like something they want you to put money into. And then it's totally based on, like, the volatility doesn't, it seems based on emotion.
Well, it's also changed over the last, like, several decades, because probably up into the 90s, the average schmuck, that would be you and I, the average schmuck could look at the stock market and get a feel of how things were working out for us. People could, in real, you know, when we had recessions and there was a recovery, you could see the stock market going up, jobs coming back, good jobs, Pete, with pay, et cetera, right? And I think what people have learned over the last several years is the stock market doesn't reflect what's going on with the average person. The average person doesn't get a better job. You know, it goes up and only the wealthy are like, they're like, hooray, we made more money from the stock market, and the average person doesn't get anything out of it.
And it seems like a lot of it has affected the economy negatively, where companies have to base things on dividends. So they have to base things on, like, they need to turn a profit, like, right now. They can't have, like, a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan.
Well, actually, if you look at, like, Amazon, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Amazon just start making a profit in 2014 or something like that? And, like, some of these huge IT business companies, people are sure that one day they're going to make a profit. And so the person starts this company, the company loses money for X amount of years. And now, sadly enough, the concept of these companies is you start the company, who cares whether or not you make money or not, you lose. And then you go public. And once you go public, you sell billions of dollars worth of stock dividends. And I mean, excuse me, worth of stocks. And then the value is in the stock market because people think you're going to make money eventually. And now you're super, super rich and you've been losing money every quarter.
And Twitter's sort of a good example of that, because where's Twitter's revenue stream come from? It's a free service.
Trump,
basically.
Maybe, I don't know. He tweets up, he's brought in a lot of people to Twitter, but they're still, are they really making money?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. And I think that, I think that that's the other aspect of it, that for a lot of people, they look at it and they go, valuations. You know, a company like Twitter has a huge valuation. I'll use another example. I think, I'm not looking at the numbers, but I think I saw something like Tesla is worth more than Ford or whatever.
And they haven't never, and they've lost, they're losing a fortune
exactly
every year.
Exactly right. Yeah. So it's based on this idea. First off, I like Elon Musk. I like Tesla. It's an innovative company and innovative products. But Ford's been making cars for a while.
Make a pretty good pickup truck, buddy. And let me tell you that.
That's
that Harley.
Right.
My sister's husband has that Harley Davidson model Ford pickup.
And so what I'm getting at is you get these valuations that seem bizarre. They just, to regular people looking at it, they go, well, how would that be worth that? And what we know is, and this is why, you know, this is why I love Steve Bannon. Steve, when he was in the White House, was talking, and Steve's a guy who was at Goldman Sachs, but as I've said before, Steve's a working class guy, came from working class Norfolk, Virginia, joined the Navy, officer in the Navy, worked in the Pentagon, got his degree, went to Harvard Business School, went to Goldman Sachs, and saw how it changed. So the traditional thing that I'm supposed to say as a Republican is rah-rah business, right? That's what I'm supposed to say. But I'm a populist. I'm a small government populist. And I'm aware that a lot of these people, and Gary Cohn, like, Gary Cohn's to me a perfect example. Well, forget Gary Cohn. Let's talk about Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is a company who's figured out they make a lot of their money by manipulating government stuff, by getting involved with other countries. In fact, a reporter who I don't like, who reports a lot of wrong stuff, but I'll give him credit on this, Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone, not a big Matt Taibbi fan. However, he wrote a piece for Rolling Stone on Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is the definition of globalism. If you're against globalism, if you're a populist, if you're against elitism, Goldman Sachs is the definition of that right
now. You know,
I would recommend people read
every
that
time
piece
you see
by
someone
Taibbi.
Crash. When you saw Detroit have the big financial crash, right? And when you started looking into it, there were all of these loans from Goldman Sachs. When Greece crashed, when you started looking into that,
the musical.
No, the actual country Greece crashed. When you look into that, you know who was in the middle of that with a bunch of loans and assuming their debt and all that stuff? Goldman Sachs. When you go around the world and you see these crashes, their hands are all in it. But I think one of the things when we talk about the job numbers now, I think just like we talk about the stock, we talk about the stock market and people look at it and say, man, it doesn't really affect me because I'm struggling. There's like, I got to print them out. There's these crazy numbers, like 50,000. I mean, like 50% of America is making less than 40,000. I mean, when you look at the numbers of what people are making, you realize that when you see X amount of jobs, right, that people are starting to realize, okay, there's 108,000 jobs or 207,000 jobs, whatever, right? But the jobs were, you know, like making tacos at Taco Bell or something. That the problem with the last few, you know, the last two recessions in 2000, 2008 were the last two bigger recessions that we had, right? The recovery didn't bring back the good jobs. So now when the government numbers come in about the jobs and say government officials or people in the stock market are all celebrating, hooray, and the traditional media is looking at it and saying, oh boy, because I believe that the mainstream media, being that they're part of the status quo, they've got a very strong reason. They've got to, you know, to try to convince everybody, to try to convince Americans that everything's okay. And that when they say, hey, look, the job market's looking good, I think the average person now, say, who's been around 2000, 2008 for these last couple of recessions, looked at it and says, but you know, the truth of the matter is, I'm not feeling anything better. And I think that's why politics are unstable. Everything's unstable because people are saying, I don't care what the job numbers are from month to month, from year to year. I'm making whatever, $30,000, $40,000 a year with a family of three or four. And that's what it's all about. People are still hurting. And these numbers that we traditionally discussed as though that meant the economy was better don't mean anything to people who really aren't making that much money anymore.
Well, allow me to be really disruptive. Allow me to be really dangerous.
I
mean,
encourage that, in fact.
Okay, well, but let me say this, because this really is something that I don't think gets discussed enough. But I did an interview a few years back with Seth Godin. Seth Godin's a big marketing business guru guy, author, written a number of books. And Seth confirmed what I think. I thought this for a long time. The job situation is never coming back the way it is. We have moved to a different era. There was a time in this world where people didn't work at factories, right? The Industrial Revolution happened, and it created factory jobs, and that led to stuff like World War II. I mean, I'm not saying it led to World War II, but like the World War II, post-World War II factory boom. That's what I'm getting at. That period is over. It's over. And the reason it's over is we're now in an information economy where labor has been outsourced. So manufacturing has been outsourced, and there's a race to the bottom with a lot of this stuff. So in other words, here's the reality. Let me give you some business advice. Here's the reality. There's a couple ways. If you want to start a business, let's say any business you want to start, there's a couple ways you can go. You can be the cheap business, or you can be the expensive business. You can be Motel 6, or you can be the Four Seasons. Now, you can also be in the middle. You can be Marriott or whatever, right? But there's two things. You can be like, I'm going to be the cheapest, or I'm going to be the nicest. Does that make sense? Any business you can put do this to. Coffee, anything. The businesses that succeed now are not the ones that are the cheapest. And the reason why is it's really hard to be the cheapest because there's always someone who can undercut you. It's generally a better play. And so I've said this, like competing against Chinese manufacturing, I don't want to do that. Now, what I'm in favor of is like small batch local businesses. Like, so for instance, if I was opening a cheese.
The kind of thing that Amazon is wiping out everywhere.
Well, that's kind of, but they also make it possible. So if I was going to open a cheese business, I thought, this is an example I used when I was up in Twin Falls, Idaho. If I was going to open a cheese business, I can try to compete with every other cheese company, or I can say, we do small batch cheese and it costs more. That's the debt, but it's the best. That's what we do. That's a better way to compete to me. And what I'd like to see, but I don't hear anybody realistically talk about this stuff. They talk about it like, oh, the jobs are going to come back. The factory jobs are never coming back. You're not going to see that because even now, the factories, there's robots and there's all these other things, and that's not going to happen. And what I think happened, Garland, was the elites who are not dumb realize this. And so they want to trick people as much as they can into thinking, oh, no, you might get those jobs back. It might go back to the 50s. You know, everyone's got this idyllic version of the 50s and 60s. What they've done is look at the things they've raised. Look at the things. A lot of things are cheaper today than ever. Entertainment is cheaper today than ever. Anything computer related, cheaper than ever. Look what's more expensive than ever. Real estate, right? Because a lot of people bought up real estate.
Okay. And that's one of the reasons that's driving the numbers. Why? But I didn't realize. I've read a couple of various articles on it when they were, the reasons why people are poorer and why people are struggling more. And one of them is the cost of living, the cost of a home. The real estate has risen as opposed to what people make. But the other thing is this: I do believe this, and that is, and I don't think this can be discounted. The fact of the matter is that within the policies driven in our government, the policies that determine, the fact of the matter is there are policies in our government that determines who gets the best shake. There means, whether the corporations, whether the wealthy, whether the poor. And I think that the people who, big pharma, as a perfect example, big pharma, how much money could be saved if they weren't allowed to jack the prices up on things, if the government was allowed to negotiate prices for Medicare, all different things. And that's just one example, right? But the thing that has happened is that these corporations have so infiltrated our government. They have so infiltrated the both parties so that the really powerful people control the policies that determine what happens to them. They determine the policies that allow them to offshore their money, that reward them for sending jobs overseas, all the things like that. They just about write the trade deals that give us the shaft. So what happens is there are, I think, a number of policies that have also, for lack of a better way, rigged the system. And I think that's about the infiltration and the takeover of our government and of our two major parties by powerful corporations. Right now, if you look at the guy, again, Bezos, not to always beat up on him, but hey, let's always beat up on him. The fact of the matter is this guy who has Amazon, who has the Washington Post, who has Whole Foods, and now he's working with the Defense Department on defense contracts and the CIA, you know what I mean? So you have these entities that so infiltrate the government, nobody can go after them for antitrust, nobody can go after them for doing anything wrong, and they're writing the rules that allow them to get everything else and shaft their employees.
They are now, but maybe. So here's the real disruptive thing I want to say. This is what I want to say, and if you're in the sound of my voice, listen to me. Don't let people run your life, period. You don't have to. One of the great things about the world today is you don't actually have to let people run your life. I have a job right now that I love. I love doing the radio show. Garland and I say it every day. We love doing the show because I was able to learn to do broadcasting by doing hundreds of podcasts on Blog Talk Radio and other places. I got better at hosting and I didn't have to go to school for it. I didn't have to get in student debt for it. I didn't have to do anything. We homeschool our kids. The reason my wife and I homeschool our kids is to make them more independent. The reason Jack is sitting here helping with this, but he knows the news and stuff, rather than being in school, is because I think it's a better use of his time to learn actual skills. Jack knows how to do stuff on the computer. He knows how to write letters. He knows how to do all kinds of stuff. You can do that for your life. if you're sitting around waiting for the corporations to help you, or for the government to help you stop, and if you understand how the system works, use it. I use Amazon products. I use Apple products. I use Google products. I'm going to keep using them to fight the system, and you can do it too. And don't sit around and be passive. No one's going to come and save you, but you can save yourself. It's a great world. So take advantage of
that. I think that goes for the person, but I also think that goes politically also, because the fact of the matter is, if you're a person like me who believes that the system is rigged and who has lost faith in the establishment government system and media system as it is today, then, you know, instead of just griping about it, there are things you can do.
Right,
you need
exactly.
to vote. You need to go protest. If you believe that there's a legitimate protest, you need to write to your whoever. And, you know, maybe you decide, you know what, I'm tired of voting for the same old Republican or Democrat, and I'm going to vote for an independent. Whatever the case you do. But to me, do something about that, too. Be a part of the political change. If you're unhappy with politics, do something different than than you've been doing. You know, the funny thing I just realized, you can't turn on CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, and nobody's going to say to you, if you're unhappy with Republicans and Democrats, maybe vote for an independent. You'll never hear that No. on any of those stations or any of those mainstream media outlets, because they all got a stop. They all got a stake in those two parties.
And I
got
to say, the establishment wants to keep people cynical. It's just the truth. They want to keep you cynical. They don't want you to have critical thinking skills. They don't want you to figure stuff out for yourself. They don't want you to be independent.
Or question the status quo.
Now, if they can get you fighting, if they can get you to be a loyal fill in the blank, I'm a loyal Republican, I'm a loyal Democrat, I'm never going to question, then you're playing their game. And by the way, they don't play this game. The elitist do not play this game.
That's what Bernie people, that's what we hear all the time. If only you'd have done what you were told and supported Hillary, we would have won. You know, if only you'd have went along with the program, we'd have won.
That's right. Coming up next hour, it is the signature stories segment, the last segment of the week here on Fault Lines, where we go over the stories that nobody else is bringing you. You're listening to Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines.
We are back. It's time for the final segment of the week here on Fault Lines, where we talk about some of the signature stories that really we're the best source for. I got to say, we're the best source. By the way, if you don't
sometimes
catch the show,
we're the only source.
Sometimes
for
we're the only source. But if you don't catch the show live, you can always watch us or listen to us later. You can follow us on iTunes and subscribe there. Please rate and review. You can go to Spreaker, another app. You can go to the Sputnik website, or you can go to the Sputnik app. Don't miss an episode of Fault Lines. We'll make you smarter every single day. So one of the stories we've been talking about, there's a few things. This is sort of a hodgepodge of things. One of the stories we've been talking about is this Awan Brothers story. This has been going on for months now. The Awan Brothers were IT specialists employed on Capitol Hill, and they worked for Democrats, including Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the now disgraced former head of the DNC, congresswoman from Florida.
During the time period in which the allegations of hacking, leaking, whatever the case may be, but during the time that all went down, the Awan brothers, as they're called in stories, they were all working for, they were actually working for Debbie Wasserman Schultz at that time, and allegedly had her password, username and password.
Now,
which
that's
is
not
a,
alleged.
Of great significance to me.
And we know from the WikiLeaks emails, for instance, that they definitely had the password for Nancy Pelosi's devices. They did. They worked for a number of Democrats. And so basically, they were accused by the Capitol Police few months ago of stealing stuff. There seems to be a cover-up about that. The media has barely covered this story, but it's factual. The Capitol Police, this is how factual it is. Then they caught Imran Iran, who's one of the Awan brothers, a few weeks ago trying to leave the country, and there was a hearing about that this morning.
After having transferred $283,000 to Pakistan.
That's right. And so this story has been barely covered, the Awan Brothers story. Luke Rosiak over at the Daily Caller has done a very good job of just laying out the facts of this. It's very non-hype on it. But my friend Jason Goodman has also been covering this. Jason is from Crowdsource the Truth. You can find him on Facebook. You can find him on Twitter. Jason, how you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, Jason, I want to go over just what you saw. Let's just keep this real factual, right? So you know me. That's how I roll. I've known Jason a long time, by the way, Garland. Jason and I go like back 20 years. So way before either of us were doing news. That's how long. So you were in the courtroom. You were in the courtroom today for the hearing, right?
Yes.
Tell us what you saw and heard. Tell us factually just what happened.
Well, you know, Imran was there with his lawyers. Chris Gowan was a lawyer who I had spoken to on the phone previously. And the real focus today was it was just a hearing where they were trying to alleviate some of the restrictions that have been put on Imran, you know, as the lead up to the trial. He's on a GPS monitored house arrest, and he can only travel within a 50-mile radius of his home. So Chris Gowan presented an argument that Imran is now driving for Uber, and that this 50-mile restriction was preventing him from earning a living, and that he needed to have it expanded to 100 miles. There was a question from the judge if they were requesting to have the GPS tracker removed, and I did observe on his wrist what I couldn't tell if it was like an Apple Watch or a Samsung watch, or it might have been the GPS tracker itself, but he definitely had some sort of, you know, fancy, shiny-looking digital wristband thing going on. And there was a question from the judge if they wanted that removed. It was a little bit difficult to hear because, you know, the courtroom, they did have microphones, but I think they intentionally make it a little bit difficult for the
people. Yeah, it is tough to hear. There. It is tough to hear in court, yeah.
Yep, and there was really very, very few people from the press at all there. There was a sketch artist, of course, and I did obtain a copy of that sketch. It's up on the Facebook page for Crowdsource the Truth, and also I tweeted it out. And the I thought that the prosecution did a good job countering the request to increase Imran's radius to 100 miles because they said that it wasn't necessary. And that, you know, I think we'd have to check with Uber how many Uber rides exceed 50 miles. I think most people are taking Uber, you know, when I ride Uber, it's like 10, 12 bucks and we're just going a couple of miles, even to the airport. I don't think most people are within, you know, 50 miles of the airport, but they also.
Well, I think BWI is within 50 miles of D.C., isn't it, Garland?
Yes, it definitely is.
Yeah. I mean, the airport, the furthest airport you'd go to from the D.C. metro area, there's three airports. There's Dulles, there's Reagan, and there's Baltimore. And Baltimore is the furthest one. That's within.
Yeah, I think there's only maybe 30 miles, something like that, at the most.
Now
it seemed Jason, disingenuous.
The other thing that I want to talk about that you did that's a big deal that I want people to go look at themselves is you interviewed somebody, a Marine, right, who rented a house that the Imran Awan did he live in it? Did Imran Awan live in this house?
No, I think they were the landlords for the house, right?
They were just landlords, right?
Well, he lived there at first. The house is 9667 Hawkshead Drive in Lorton, Virginia. And it's one of the houses that the Congressional Federal Credit Union bank fraud was involved in. Or, you know, the house with the whole mortgage on the house and the loan for the house and everything is part of this bank fraud case, which so far, those are the only charges brought.
And that's public information, but obviously, but no one go to the house, leave the house alone. I mean, right? I mean,
no, you should. Well, none of them live there anymore.
Imran
doesn't own it. The house has been sold. Imran doesn't own it. Andre Taggart doesn't live there anymore.
And Andre Taggart, let's just be clear, he's the guy who lives. He lived in the house, but people, you know, whatever. So he lived in the house and he found some hard drives. You interviewed him, right? And where can people just tell people, because I want people to know where they can watch the whole interview.
Yeah, if you go on YouTube and just in the search on YouTube, look for Crowdsource the Truth. It's one of the first ones. It's called Andre Taggart in His Own Words. And it's about a 1 hour interview in which Marine veteran Andre Taggart explains how he rented this home from Imran Awan. And he rented it through a website called militarybyowner.com, which I found interesting that Imran chose to specifically put it on a rental site geared towards military people.
Well, actually, a lot of people that rent do that because, you know, they get people in the military get extra pay, and it's usually they're pretty solid paying. You know what I mean? They get extra money from the government for their rent. So usually if you get a military person renting, it's pretty solid that you're going to get paid every month.
And that's rent.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why there's no website called Journalist by Owner or anything like that. They don't want to rent to journalists for a good reason.
You know, skateboarders, or something like that.
Skateboarding journalist by owner is very unpopular.
You're losing.
So anyway, he said, so he'd rented the house and.
Well, the most interesting aspects of what he said was that, you know, he was a Marine. He's been in the Marines for 14 years and he recognized there were Blackberries, there were laptops, there were hard drives. He recognized on the Blackberries certain markings that indicated to him that they were government issued Blackberries. And so he turned them in right away to the FBI. And he says in the interview, you know, he was very reluctant to even handle these things because he knew right away they were not supposed to be there. And he goes into detail about how Imran got upset. A certified letter arrived at the house that Andre signed for, and that upset Imran. You know, Imran was very polite and courteous in court today, although he did give me the stink eye pretty hard. It seemed like he recognized who I was. I guess he's watching YouTube. But
well, he's got a lot of time now between Uber rides. Now, here's the Jason. I just want to say this too. So, when you interviewed this Andre Taggart, you were obviously there's a lot of other media who were trying to interview this guy, right? You were up against MSNBC and CNN and the New York Times, right?
I don't think those guys really were trying to get to him at all. He said he had been contacted by the Washington Post.
That's interesting. But is that it?
I think so. I mean, you know, I haven't seen any other interviews of him.
And I just would think, and so the reason we want to highlight this, Jason Goodman, thanks very much for joining
us today. So a little bit more about today. Thank you. A little bit more about today. Apparently there was a letter. So, as we know, the hearing today was regarding the bank fraud, but apparently there was documents that suggested a larger investigation. There was a letter about evidence in the case. The U.S. attorney, who was Channing Phillips, described the probe as one that involved voluminous discovery, citing items that were found in a congressional office back in April, which seemingly may have belonged to a Juan. So it's obvious, based on the documents submitted today in the court by the U.S. attorney, that this is not just about bank fraud. They made specific reference to items found in the congressional office building, and that there was a voluminous discovery, which means their discovery is when you ask for various you know, someone, if you were being sued and someone sent you a letter of discovery, they would be asking you for various things that you have to produce for the court. So apparently they're sending out discovery letters to someone who knows who, but they're asking for voluminous. They're asking for a lot of stuff. So you're not doing that for a bank fraud investigation, most likely.
And what I want to point out is that Jason is a guy, again, I've known Jason's worked in TV and film. That's where I know Jason.
Okay.
Why is Jason the guy who's out there doing the hour-long interview with Taggart that's posted? Why aren't the mainstream media covering this? This is clearly a major story. Furthermore, the other thing that we didn't even get into is that even after these accusations were made, even after the arrest were made, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was still paying this guy. Imran Awan was still on the payroll.
Let's not forget that it's something that we talk about, and that is the tie between the establishment media and the establishment government figures. Let's not forget that during the primaries, when Mika Brzezinski had made some statements about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and said that, you know, that information had come out from WikiLeaks that she was, you know, that she had, you know, put her foot on the scales against Bernie. When that came out, there's emails where she indicated she was going to call Phil Griffin, the head of MSNBC, yeah, and gripe and complain. So, you know, when you already know that a Debbie Wasserman Schultz and people like her have direct lines to the president of MSNBC, CNN, whoever, you know, you recognize that these major media outlets, if remember Fox News recently with Rupert Murdoch wanting Bannon gone, that these major media outlets are just like interconnected to political establishment to a point where if it's something they don't want them to cover, they ain't touching it.
And I want to point out the importance of what I think we're doing here. And that's important why you listen. And it's important why you share the show with people you know. We're telling you. First off, we had Jason on. I really appreciate it. Again, you can find him at Crowdsource the Truth. Just Google that, or Crowdsource the Truth on Facebook or on Twitter. But go, don't take our word for anything. I'm not having him, we're not telling you. Well, sources tell us that, you know, the person who rented the house, he's got an hour-long interview he did with Andre Taggart. You can go watch it yourself, and you have to. We are at an age now where the buyer needs to beware. You need to be very careful because the media, and I'm not just saying the establishment media, lots of media outlets have an agenda. New media outlets have an agenda. And maybe it's political, and maybe it's clicks, and maybe it's who's funding them, and maybe it's ego, which everybody has.
Just as to throw this out, just as earlier this week, I think it might have been yesterday, the day before, we talked about the fact that there were some think tanks here in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
Where the people reported, either reporting or supporting people who were looking into Google for antitrust, and Google had people fired. It appears, I'll put it like this. I'm not saying Google had people fired, but Google funded the think tank and the people were fired when they said
the
things that Google didn't like.
People were fired, and the report, and you can read the report. It was a good report in the New York Times.
Yep.
And again, I'm critical of the New York Times every day. This was a good story by Ken Vogel, who's done great reporting, and also I'm critical of sometimes. But this was a well-reported story where he had the email from the woman, Anne Marie Slaughter, who runs New America Foundation, tens of millions of dollars.
$21 million they've gotten from Google since 1999.
And she told the guy who was fired, think about what you're doing because this could affect our funding. Now, I'm just saying this is the problem. So the problem is, and this is why I tell people, I just told you, it's a good story in the New York Times. And some days I'm going to be real critical. Today I could be real critical of 9 stories in the New York Times. But that's why I say it's buyer beware. You've never had more information available to you. We are one source, and we've tried to provide you with information to link you to other sources and try to provide you something where we say, look, I think this is a good story. Read this. This one I'm skeptical on. But at the end of the day, you got to make up your own mind.
The other thing is, you know what I say to people? Okay, so this guy's name is Andre Taggart. There's something that we said, hey, okay, this guy did a video on it. But you know what? Go to Google, go to Yahoo News, go to whatever you want to do. DuckDuckGo, that's a new search engine a lot of people are going with. Go there, put in the name Andre Taggart. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do what Lee and I do. You know, that's the one thing that most media outlets aren't going to do is say, look, go to several different search engines. And put in the name Andre Taggart. Put in any name you want to. If any of the stories that we report on that you have some concern with, go look it up yourself. Find out what makes sense to you. That's the one thing that you don't get that we encourage everybody to do. I'm not any smarter than you. I just do this for a living. I look this stuff up. But you can do it. Don't trust me. Don't trust Lee. Look it up yourself.
Now, one of the other stories that I just want to mention, we covered this a little bit this week, but we'll be talking a lot more about in the coming weeks, is this DNC Ukraine story. This continues to move forward. And like this Awan Brothers story, one of the things I say is listen very carefully to what the media doesn't tell you. Listen very carefully, because the number one way that they can censor things is simply by not covering them at all. This Awan Brothers story, if they were covering it every single day, if the Washington Post were putting reporters on it, like they had this guy talk to Andre Taggart, where did that go? Did that lead to? They could. Here's the fact. Trump Russia showed that the mainstream media can cover a story with a lot of reporters every single day. And the problem is, and I've said this before, sites like Breitbart, their solution is, well, we won't cover it as much. That's what Alex Marlow, the editor over there, has said. That's a bad solution. Why not cover it? Why not help people figure out what's actually going on? Now, with this DNC Ukraine story, I'm going to repeat what I've said before. This is very important. The government of Ukraine is now looking into DNC Ukrainian collusion. That's been reported by Politico. We reported it here a few weeks ago. That's continuing to go on. I just want to keep it in your head a little bit.
And let me add this, something that Lee and I both said. I actually looked at the trailer. But this weekend, I plan on, and something that I suggest for other people, there's a video, it's an Oliver Stone documentary called Ukraine on Fire. And if you want to understand what's up with Ukraine, you know, some of the dynamics of what's happening in Ukraine and why and how, that's a great video. I mean, that's a great documentary. It's online. It's called Ukraine on Fire.
And you'll see If you watch this film, and again, we're not working on a commission basis here. It is a very dense film that really covers a lot of the history. And the thing I think people need to be concerned about is it's very clear to me that the tactics that were used to overthrow the Ukrainian government and get Viktor Yanukovych out of there, those same tactics are being used here right now in the United States. It's very clear to me. It's the same people. It's John McCain. It's the Obama administration, right? It's the same people fomenting the same types of violence.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you there because there is no Obama administration because President Obama is gone. So we got to go in a different direction.
Doesn't make any difference.
Obama administration.
Well, let me explain. One of the women who was behind this stuff, for instance, is Evelyn Farkas. Evelyn Farkas was a Obama State Department. You're hearing. You don't think Obama? We know for a fact Obama administration people have been pushing the Russian narrative. We know for a fact.
Oh, I know
it's
that.
Ben yeah. Rhodes and other people. So when I say that, it is the same people. It's the same people from the Obama administration who are pushing this Trump-Russian narrative.
Let me throw this into that. And when you talk about the neocons, Victoria Nuland, who played a major part in the 2014 coup in Ukraine. Her husband is Robert Kagan, one of the neocons, who again they were at the cutting edge of the whole Iraq war and the Bush administration war cabinet. So the other thing you look at is this. You see whether it was the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and now the people who have pushed who have changed Donald Trump, who have flipped him from a guy who was going to pull everybody out of Afghanistan to keeping people in Afghanistan. You see that it's the same people who, regardless of the administration, regardless of the ideology, they always find their way in to get their war.
That's right. And I got to say this, too. Our hopes and prayers go out to the people dealing with everything in Houston. It's a rough situation. We will be back on Tuesday.
And I won't be on Fox. I just got an email. I'm not going to be on Fox now because the president's going to be landing in Houston and they're going to do rolling coverage on Fox News.
That's great. We will see you next week. Coming back at you, you're listening to the most disruptive radio show in America, It's Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines.